Hello again, friends, and welcome to Madison BookBeat, your listener-supported community radio home for Madison authors, topics, book events, and publishers. I'm your host, Stu Levitan. For our last show of 2021, a special encore presentation that hits all four criteria, a conversation with the late R. Richard Dick Wagner of blessed memory about his book, Coming Out, Moving Forward, Wisconsin's Recent Gay History. It's from our very good friends at the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, which in 2019 published the companion volume We've Been Here All Along, Wisconsin's Early Gay History, which we featured last week. And of course, Dick presented both books at the Wisconsin Book Festival. In this age when same-gender marriage is a constitutional right and an out gay man was a serious candidate for president, it may be hard for some of our younger listeners to believe that there was a time, not too long ago, when Wisconsin criminalized what consenting adults did in the privacy of their own bedroom, and employers could fire someone just because they were gay. How the LGBTQ community overturned a century and a half of oppressive legislation and made American gay history is the business that occupies Dick Wagner in Coming Out, Moving Forward, along with an in-depth analysis of Wisconsin's response to AIDS, gay life and culture, heroes and villains of the fight for gay rights, and so much more. There was no one more qualified or appropriate to write this groundbreaking history of recent gay life in Wisconsin than Dick Wagner, who was a leading player in several of these stories as co-chair of the Governor's Council on Lesbian and Gay Issues and the first openly gay chair of a county board in Wisconsin. Dick came to Madison as a graduate student in history in 1965, getting his doctorate in 1971. In 1972, Governor Pat Lucey named him Executive Director of the American Revolution Bicentennial Commission. After Lucey resigned in the summer of 1977 to become Ambassador to Mexico, Dick ran the executive residence for Acting Governor Martin Schreiber until January 1979, when he joined the Department of Administration as a budget analyst. Dick retired from state service in 2005. In addition to co-chairing the Governor's Council and serving on the Dane County Board from 1980 to 1994, including 4 years as chair, Dick's record of state and local public service was extensive. In recognition not just of his service, but the way he served, Dick was named the first recipient of the City of Madison's Jeffrey Clay Erlanger Civility in Public Discourse Award in 2007. I'm not sure if it figured in the award, but Dick was also the man who single-handedly saved the Mazomanie Nude Beach, although I'm not sure he ever went. And on a personal note, I had the pleasure of serving with Dick on the Dane County Board from 1982 to 1987, and on the Plan Commission a bit after that, and there was no one whose intelligence, integrity, and decency I respected more, then or now. Dick's sudden death from a heart attack earlier this month was a terrible blow, and I'm pleased I can share this conversation with you now. I want to start with the cover of the book, four pictures of individuals and groups of people. Tell us about, some of them are very famous, some are unknown to the general public. Tell us about the cover.
Up on the top right, we have Lou Sullivan, who is a transgendered person who used to write for GPU News, that's Gay People's Union News in Milwaukee. He wrote on trans issues there and went on to become a national leader in the female-to-male transsexual community. On the bottom, you have members in the AIDS Walk over in Milwaukee. And then you have a women activist in Madison marching at one of the gay rights, gay sisters marches. And then you have a group of out-elected officials, which is a proud tradition in Wisconsin, and they were celebrating the fifth anniversary of Wisconsin's gay rights law.
One of them, of course, is David Clarenbach. We'll talk in more detail about the role David Clarenbach played in some of the huge legislative successes, but just tell us briefly a bit about David Clarenbach.
David became became an elected supervisor of the Dane County Board at the age of 18. He then went on to become a member of the State Assembly, where he served for several decades and was a major leader on gay rights issues in the state.
The first really big issue you talk about in the narrative is the saga of Paul Safransky, who was a flamboyantly out gay man who was fired from his job as a house parent at Southern Colony for mentally impaired older boys. He appealed. It went up to the state Supreme Court. The state attorney general at the time, Robert Warren, who later became a federal judge under Richard Nixon, filed a brief which you accurately describe as vilifying homosexuals, said they preyed on, that they were child molesters, preyed on the mentally impaired. That part is obviously not true, but he also said that, quote, the general population has a well-known disgust for homosexuals and refer to them as queer or strange, and that homosexuality is not regarded as socially or morally acceptable by a majority of Americans. Even though that should not and did not matter as a matter of law, and the court said there was no evidence in the record for that, as a factual matter, you lived here in 1972. How true was that statement in Wisconsin?
It was probably true then, but the brilliant brief filed by David Adamany was a real challenge to that, trying to show changing attitudes. And he didn't cite just court cases. He would cite Marcus Welby, MD, TV shows, the movie Sunday, Bloody Sunday, Ann Landers columns, and the circulation itself of GPU news in the state to show that attitudes were changing. And that's what he was trying to get the court to recognize, not fully successfully, but at least partially. He did challenge that finding that the personnel board made, that they hadn't made a record on that.
You mentioned Marcus Welby and Ann Landers. What was the relationship between cultural acceptance, social acceptance, political acceptance, and legal acceptance? Did they proceed in that line, or was there some other dynamic at play?
There was interactions going on all the time. And one of the things I try to argue in the book is that Wisconsin very quickly made political, legal advances, decriminalizing homosexuality with passing the first in the nation gay rights bill. And those things empowered the social changes that enabled people in places like Eau Claire and La Crosse to form gay organizations and to start asserting their own rights. And so it's the interplay between those things that was going on in Wisconsin. In some cases, I like to argue that Wisconsin was a gay laboratory for democracy, in that we were on the forefront of so many things in the 80s, and that caused a tremendous flowering of LGBT community around the state.
But can you say which of those four came first? Did the cultural acceptance?
Cultural acceptance is still lingering. I mean, the marriage equality action by the state vote against marriage equality in 2006 is certainly a sign that the cultural acceptance was not well established yet. It's not one or the other. It's their interplay between them that I think is significant.
You came to the UW in 1965, which was only a couple of years after the Lavender Purge at the university ended, where they were getting rid of gay students and probably some gay faculty. Did you know about that at the time? And did any of that filter down to your graduate student level?
Didn't know about it at the time, and wasn't aware in my graduate student level. In my graduate student level, we were so consumed by the anti-war movement and organizing and trying to restructure the university. I was a member of the History Students Association, which was an SDS front organization. And, you know, we were trying to challenge the way the educational system went. But part of that was a sense of opening up the system to broader concerns than what traditionally had been. And that would eventually benefit LGBT people as well.
And what was your progressive degree of outness when you came, when you worked for first governor, for the Bicentennial Commission, then Governor Schreiber, and then finally got elected to the county board? How out were you at each step of the way?
Those kinds of personal decisions are a progression too. In 74, I ran for the city council on a gay rights plank, was in my literature, both early and late pamphlets that I put out. In the late 70s, I joined the advisory committee for the gay center. So I was comfortable with being identified with a gay organization. And then also, we did some fundraisers in my house for the gay center and for the United and Alice B. Toklas party, and a night in old San Francisco and a night in Key West. And then I was doing in 82 a panel at the request of the United, and Lynn Hanen and I were there, and we spoke of ourselves both as members of the gay community. I was very comfortable self-identifying at that point as a member of the gay community. What I didn't know was there was a reporter from the Daily Cardinal who picked up the story, didn't treat it as any great news. And then Barb Mulhern from the Capital Times picked it up and became a big splashy story featured in the evening newspaper.
Did you feel
at that point, I assumed everybody knew, but of course they didn't.
Did you feel you were effectively, if unintentionally, outed?
No, I didn't feel like it was unintentional. I made those conscious steps about my own progression as to what I was willing to do and how I was willing to identify. So I didn't feel like I was outed.
Your own attitude towards outing people, even if they are hostile to gay rights, if your attitude is that it's still their choice?
In general, that's my attitude. I mean, enemies of the community deserve less sympathy, and perhaps, you know, if there's some evidence that they, you know, misplaced something, that maybe that evidence could be highlighted. But in general, I still think it's a personal choice.
I tried to pitch a story about a certain well-known Wisconsinite to a Wisconsin travel magazine. it did not go well. Scott Klug didn't buy the pitch, that's all I can say. While the Safransky thing was going, while Safransky saga was going on, that's when Madison started dealing with adding protection to its equal opportunities ordinance. It started by talking about sexual preference, then became sexual orientation. It took about a year and a half from late 73 to early 1975. Why did it take so long, and what were the discussions like about that terminology?
Part of it was is that the movement itself was sort of figuring out what was appropriate. You have to realize that the ignorance about homosexuality existed within the gay community as well as outside of the gay community, so that they were sorting out whether things like sexual preference or sexual orientation was the correct terms. And so finally they came back with a recommendation to the EEOC, which was drafting the ordinance changes, that orientation was the term they wanted to be used. But there were still variances happening in that point in the 70s. It took a while because they went back and forth on drafts as to who would be included. At one point, Alder Shivers had included gender identity issues in the ordinance. They came back and did not include that in the end as being too controversial, is what Jim Yaden told me. There was a process in drafting, and it was lengthy. But Mayor Soglin worked hard to get broad support for the changes that were coming forth. He particularly enlisted the help of Reverend James Wright, who was the director of the EOC and also a pastor at Mount Zion Baptist Church. Part of that was so you didn't get into this, oh, blacks deserve rights and gays don't deserve rights kinds of things, that everybody deserves rights, and that became sort of the impetus behind it. It was adopted without controversy, without debate, didn't even make the papers the next day. It was only later that some evangelicals in the fervor of the Anita Bryant uprising tried to repeal parts of the ordinance, and that was turned aside by the efforts of the Madison United getting formed.
Let's jump to that, because that takes place in 1978, and the local pastor, Wayne Dillabaugh, turns out to play a critical role in development of the Madison gay community. We're talking with Dick Wagner. His book is coming out, Moving Forward, Wisconsin's Recent Gay History, from our friends at the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. So by 1978, we've already had Jim Yaden appointed to the Common Council.
He was elected in 77 after the appointment. He was the fourth out elected person in the nation.
He's on the county board. He's on the city council even a year before Harvey Milk is elected to the
Harvey Milk was elected in the fall. Jim was reelected to the city council in the spring election of April, but he had been appointed the previous fall. So yeah, he was a full alder for a year before Harvey got elected.
Now, did they choose him because he was gay, despite his being gay, or was that a non-factor?
Apparently it wasn't a factor, as far as I could tell from what I saw in the discussions about it.
So we get to 1978. We've got a local gay elected officials. Explain how Wayne Dillabaugh unintentionally plays an important role in the development of important gay infrastructure in Madison.
He was inspired by the Anita Bryant effort that was burgeoning around the country to repeal gay rights ordinances. And so he wanted to repeal Madison's ordinance. And so he started to organize some evangelical pastors to do that. And they presented a petition. In the end, Dillabaugh was sort of shunted aside because of some other controversies. And so the leadership fell to Reverend Richard Pritchard, and they focused on exempting what they thought were sensitive positions like schools and things like that, where obviously they didn't think you should be around young people if you were gay. The Madison EOC turned that back. There was a big anti-Anita bash held at Memorial Union, and Yadin, Soglin, and others spoke. And there was a whole series of mainstream religious folks who supported no change in the ordinance, that they argued that, no, we do not want to support discrimination in our community. And so you had sort of the moral balance of religious folks on both sides arguing about the matter. And that was significant in the state also at large, because in this state, the gay community embraced religious allies, where in some cases that was not necessarily done. And that became really successful when we get to the legislation in the 1980s.
Yeah, we'll talk especially about the role of Rembert Weakland and others when we get to that. But something about Richard Pritchard, in the 1960s, he was an absolute soldier for civil rights. I mean, he actually went to Alabama. He went to the Deep South. And then in the 70s, he just goes mad over sex issues. And he takes on massage parlors and gay rights. And it's so tragic how he so ruined his reputation.
No accounting for things in this world.
Now, most of the important gay politicians have been, at the very least, liberal and sometimes far left. But there was one gay politician in Madison in the 1980s who was a Republican, Jim McFarland. Talk about the role that he played in alternate family legislation at the city level.
Jim McFarland actually had sort of the gay seat in the fraternity row district, which had a whole number of out elected officials. And he and his partner at the time had been involved in some of the anti-ROTC issues on campus. And so he ran and he got elected, and he became the strong advocate for alternative families legislation. And the EOC did a whole study about that, supported and encouraged by the Madison Institute for Social Legislation. He got sort of in two phases most of those provisions enacted that Madison would recognize domestic partnerships and provide certain non-discriminatory provisions for them. But it was a long, hard struggle. And I remember strategizing with several alders about what we could get through the council win and things like that about it.
How important was that issue in Paul Soglin beating Joe Sensenbrenner in the next election?
I think it was important because Sensenbrenner waffled on the issue. I know a number of people in the gay community immediately who had previously supported Sensenbrenner switched to Paul Soglin. It was one of the things I think helped propel Paul to his second round of terms as mayor.
The heart of the book and what makes it important on a national level is the discussion of those two huge legislative victories in the early 80s, the so-called Gay Rights Bill and the Consenting Adults Bill. Remind people what the state of criminal and employment law was as the 1980s opened.
Well, Wisconsin, like many other states, had sex laws going back to the English Tudor times, statutes on sexual perversion. And the acts were illegal both for homosexuals and heterosexuals, but they were almost never enforced against heterosexuals. One of the things that the gay community did was they created various coalitions for sexual privacy, trying to argue that these laws should not be enforced or shouldn't be on the books, because they did affect both gays and straights. In fact, there were very few straights who ever joined the coalitions for sexual privacy since they weren't really being bothered for the most part. Decriminalizing the status of homosexuals was thought very important to try and begin that conversation about equality, since very few people wanted to defend people who were criminals. That led to the discussion about equal rights. And so you had Madison, which did an ordinance in 75 about non-discrimination. City of Milwaukee did one in 1980, and the Dane County Board did one in 1980, as you may remember from being on that board.
Was there an individual who came up, who realized, let's start with consenting adults and then move to gay rights? Or was it just sort of a bubble up from the community at large?
Both issues had been introduced by Lloyd Barbie, who was the prophet of sex reform in Wisconsin in the early 70s. But Barbie didn't expect his bills to go anywhere. They were to educate the legislature about the need for change. And then David Clarenbaugh really became sort of the champion for the consenting adults bill. And he was the one pushing for that, in the sense that there was felt that that was the first step. And so as early as 1977 session, you had the assembly vote favorably about repealing the sex perversion laws, but then it failed. And it wasn't actually until the 83 session that you finally passed consenting adults legislation. But it was constantly fought for the next several sessions, and new strategies were determined as you went along and figured out what was important and how to get more allies in support of the bill.
Lloyd Barbie, not only the prophet and the father of sexual freedom laws in Wisconsin, is also the father of the Fair Housing Code in the city of Madison. He was the first one to propose that in 1962, and the man who helped strike down segregation in the Milwaukee public schools. Lloyd Barbie is one of those really important people at various levels for years and years.
Yep, he was a major influence in the state, and he saw the seamlessness of rights for all groups, and he would speak unfavorably of the Menominee trying to restore their tribal rights as a nation, as well as women's rights, as well as gay rights. So he was a real strong advocate.
And we should note that our friends at the Historical Society Press have also published his daughter Daphne Wooten Barbie's collection of his writings called With Justice for All, the collected writings of Lloyd Barbie. Remind people David's comment about that consenting adults bill and who does and who doesn't follow it.
One of David's arguments at a hearing was that 95% of Wisconsin's violated the sexual perversion statutes and the other 5% had no imagination.
Was it David who also realized that consenting adults was a more sellable term than sodomy law? I mean, because in
Minnesota... Yes, we talked to some friends in Minnesota and they were working on sodomy repeal. You know, that doesn't sound anywhere near as good as consenting adults law. And in fact, there was some enforcement of the, statutes against heterosexuals as well, in terms of living together and things like that, which was viewed as fornication. But more the laws were enforced against gay folks and used to entrap them.
Yeah, I was disappointed. Of all the religious leaders who supported it, I was very surprised and disappointed to see that the Reverend Alfred Swan of the First Congregational Church here in Madison did not support the consenting adults bill.
No, he didn't.
Why Wisconsin? Was it just because we had the visionary Lloyd Barbie and the clever tactician David Clarenbeck, or was there something deeper in our people and our politics that put us in the forefront?
Well, I think there was some things in our politics. Part of it was that you had, when young Bob La Follette Jr. went back into the Republican Party in 46 to fight that primary fight against Joe McCarthy, which he lost, many of the Progressive Party followers went back into the Republican Party with him. Some of them were still there in the 80s when these measures came up in the legislature. And so you wouldn't have passed it without Republican votes. But the other thing that was important was that the Democratic Party had been rebuilt after World War II into a liberal party rather than a mere FDR patronage party along the lakeshore cities. And it had a very liberal bent. So myself and many other advocates had in the 1970s gone to state Democratic conventions and passed resolutions in support of decriminalization and non-discrimination. And so those issues became part of the Democratic platform, which presumably, at least in name, the Democratic leaders were committed to, even though many of them put it lower on their priority list. But when you got a leader like David in the legislature who began to really push this as an item on the agenda, the Democratic leadership knew that members in their party were willing to support it. And so they responded to that. And the response of the Democratic leadership and with the gay community lobbying and with the progressive Republicans willing to vote for it was a very unique combination. Didn't happen in many other places, and it happened here because of those things.
I get a sense that a lot of what progressives accomplished in the late 70s and early 80s was built on the infrastructure that Pat Lucey created in the early 1970s. I mean, you're an example of you and, I mean, David Adamany, the fact that Patrick Lucey stood by David Adamany, even as he's outing himself and being appointed to a cabinet job. I mean, Pat Lucey was another fundamental block in that structure.
It was, and you saw Lucey's involvement evolving when the Young Democrats adopted their sex plank, which I talk about in volume one in 1966. He sort of poo-pooed it. But right before he left to go become ambassador to Mexico, he's asked about the Anita Bryant thing, and he sort of downplays the Anita Bryant things and doesn't support her crusade to repeal non-discrimination laws. And so he himself had changed in that simple decade, and maybe his involvement with David Adamany was one of the reasons that he himself had evolved on that, as well as he was a good political reader. He saw the Democratic Party changing with all those convention votes and other things that had been happening at those party meetings in the early 70s.
So how was it that even though work on the consenting adults bill started first to set the framework for discussing the issues, it was actually the gay rights bill that passed first?
Part of it was that you got some support for gay rights from the religious community that they weren't willing to do necessarily publicly on consenting adults. Charlie Phillips was the chief lobbyist for the Wisconsin Catholic Conference, which was the bishops from around the state. He was asked about consenting adults bill, and basically he said they didn't have a position about that. But when it came to the non-discrimination bill, Archbishop Rembrandt Weakland had spoken out about the issue of non-discrimination towards homosexuals. And he was basing that upon a teaching that had been adopted by the Catholic bishops. When he was not yet a bishop, he was still abbot primate of the Benedictine order in 76, when the Catholic bishops adopted a letter to American Catholics called Live in Christ Jesus, in which they spoke of non-discrimination towards homosexuals. So, but Weakland became the vocal voice of that position here in the state in publications in the Milwaukee Archdiocesan newspaper. And so his spokespeople helped pass that City of Milwaukee non-discrimination law in 1980. And then Leon Rouse, an activist, organized a committee for fundamental Judeo-Christian human rights, which had religious leaders who particularly lobbied for the non-discrimination bill. And so all of a sudden it had a head of steam in the 81 session with all of this religious support. I like to joke that there was like a chorus of bishops, because Weakland was joined by Marjorie Matthews, a Methodist bishop, several Lutheran bishops, and several leaders of Presbyterian groups in the state, as well as American Baptist and UCC congregations. Some of the people speaking for the for the consenting adults bill early on had been the Unitarian ministers, Reverend Tony Larson from Racine. And so you had this big effort by the religious community that gave a push to non-discrimination law. In fact, the New York Native, the gay paper, ran its headline, Nuns in the Gallery, about the passage of Wisconsin's non-discrimination law.
And actually, you've always struck me as something of an Episcopalian bishop might yourself.
I come from a Catholic tradition.
Now, for all of Weakland's involvement, did anybody know or suspect that he was a closeted gay man?
It certainly was not known at the time. But Weakland was not alone in his position on that. I mean, some have sort of tried to say that was special pleading. You had a whole series of other Catholic groups. The National Federation of Catholic Priests had adopted a position about this. In the state, the Milwaukee Archdiocese Sisters adopted. One of the people who would lobby for the bill was a member of the School Sisters of Notre Dame out of Milwaukee. You had Father Tony Schumacher from Madison here, who spoke for the Peace and Justice Group for the Madison Diocese. You had a priest in Green Bay. So there was a broad consensus among Catholics that this is something that they could support. It wasn't a matter, I think, of special pleading.
You note that Lloyd Barbee and David Clarenbeck both had backgrounds in civil rights. David as a child with his parents. Lloyd, as I mentioned, being a leader in the local and state NAACP. Yet they didn't use traditional civil rights tactics in this matter of sit-ins and marches and pickets, but played a real establishment game of endorsements and legislative compromise.
Right.
Why was that? Why didn't they use those traditional civil rights tactics?
Because in part they were insiders and they felt they could use the levers of power and didn't need to use the outside levers of power. And that's one of the things that was also important to me about the book, was that how the gay community learned to use levers of power to become part of the levers of power. That was significant too. I remember talking with some of my colleagues from New York, and they talked about how they had to work their way up through the West Side Democratic clubs and stuff like that before they could even be a candidate. Here in Wisconsin, you go out and stand on a corner and get 20 signatures on a petition, and you're a candidate, and you're on the ballot, and you can run for office. I mean, the openness of our political system encouraged a whole raft of gay and lesbian people to run for office, and a significant number of them were successful. So again, I think that's one of the unique things about Wisconsin and its political structures that enabled this opening to the gay community to occur.
And sometimes you can even use that openness of the political process to get around a school ban on discussing gay issues in school.
Right. That was Judy Greenspan. She was, I think, the first out lesbian in the nation to run, and she had been denied being able to speak at East High School for an intersession thing. After the students invited her, the principal said no. And so she decided, well, I'll run for the school board. And then she got invited to speak at forums in high schools. And so, you know, that's really political smarts about how to use the system.
Did the legislative leaders who are trying to shepherd the bills through ever get, concerned or upset about what outside groups might be doing in terms of political protests that could embarrass the insiders?
There didn't seem to be that. I mean, GPU News to an extent other gay media in the state were pretty good about educating the community about the progress of all these bills. They would report on hearings. They would report on support. They report on the lobbying groups. Early on, GPU News published a survey that was done for legislators where they stood on gay issues and helped define what they were. Because they had published that consenting adults was how the community wanted to speak about it, legislators returned that language to them and learned to speak about consenting adults as a way to decriminalize sexual perversion. So, it was an early political sophistication in this state that I think was remarkably successful. You also had some other things that happened in the 80s, in that since David was a key factor in the Democratic caucus in the assembly, when it came to budget bills, he could get language inserted that would protect HIV confidentiality, and they would insert legislation that would protect student rights so that those hadn't been included in the original gay rights bill. And so they put provisions protecting students from discriminatory conduct in their schools. And that became very important as a leading case for Wisconsin as well.
And you have another example during the legislative debate on why it's important not just to be at the table, but to be at the head of the table. Talk about how Dick Flintrop made sure that some objections did not come up during the legislative debates.
Right. Dick Flintrop. And this is the other thing that was interesting to me, is that people like Dick Flintrop and Steve Gunderson and David Berger, who are all gay legislators, but not out personally, signed on as members of these sexual privacy coalitions trying to get consenting adults bill overruled. But again, the school board association came to the legislature and they wanted to get an exemption on the gay rights non-discrimination bill for schools. And since the Democrats were in the majority, he was shopping around for a Democratic sponsor, and all of the Democratic legislators told him he had to go talk to Dick Flintrop, who was chair of the education committee in the assembly. And Flintrop, as chair, had the power to decide whether any bills which the association might ever be interested in would be on an agenda of his committee. And he told him no to that amendment, and it was quietly folded and put away. So clearly, in that sense, the community used its political power and skills to get what it needed to get.
And that's kind of the same tactic you used to protect the Mesomeini nude beach.
It was indeed. I told the sheriff, we're never having an ordinance that's going to let you enforce those things other than state statute, which the DA didn't want to enforce any state statute issues. So.
And since you were chair of the Public Protection Judiciary Committee right before me, you were able to enforce that. And thankfully, they didn't come to me and try and push it through when I was chair. One of the things that jumps out in this narrative is just how well the legislative process worked. It was bipartisan. It may have worked a little slowly, but there was an actual legislative process where they heard from the people, they considered amendments, it must have made you wistful to look back on this time of an actual functioning state government.
It does in certain ways. In fact, Will Fellows, who's written Farm Boys about gay farm folks and also about gay preservationists, was one of the people who read the book for some editorial concerns. And he said after he got through reading the story of the legislative advance, he was just sort of weeping as to how it had worked. But that was remarkable that it did work in those days, and it could work. The thing I tried to do was by showing the various sessions is that how Republicans learned that they could vote for consenting adults and they wouldn't be published. And so punished, in other words. And so they were willing to continue that support when it came to the gay rights bill and when the final enactment of consenting adults occurred. So, the community learned its lessons along the way. It didn't just bludgeon its way through, but it had a remarkable political sophistication.
Is there anything you learned about this episode that you didn't know at the time, but you learned during doing the research for this book?
I'd learned some of the fringes. I was pretty involved in some of the efforts myself by that point. I was testifying at some of the hearings and things like that. So, and I was very close to David. I can remember drinking champagne in his office after the gay rights bill passed, something we probably shouldn't have been doing in the Capitol, but we did. So. Yeah.
And there's a fascinating coda to the gay rights bill involving the Rawhide Boys Ranch, which shows what a really excellent legislator he was.
Right, because they tried to get a special exemption. Again, this is the whole religious liberty issue. And so it was amazing to me that these issues, again, Wisconsin was pioneering how these would be enacted and fought about in the 1980s and early 90s. So David was able to work with Democratic legislators to block a broad exemption for Rawhide. They did a slight narrow expansion of the religious exemption after a Supreme Court ruling over the Mormons, or the Amish, I think. And so, but he was extremely skillful in watching out for these things and for getting the right persons at the right tables to decide on these things.
And even before Rawhide became a statewide issue, it was a Dane County issue. And it was actually one of the first big controversies after I joined you on the county board in 1982. It was essentially you against Bart Starr, and you won.
I did. And David won, too, when Bart Starr came and testified to the legislature. So Bart may be good at football, but he was not so good at politics.
Briefly recount that story.
Well, Rawhide Boys Ranch was a facility, again, for troubled teenagers, and it got almost all of its money from public funding from counties who had placed children there at the Rawhide Boys Ranch. And the ranch had not a pastor, was not a religious institution, but they claimed to only hire married couples for house parents, and they refused to hire homosexuals. And so Dane County, when they refused to file an affirmative action statement with Dane County, as required by our ordinance, which was enacted in 1980 with that county board action, they came up for disbarment for any future placements for Dane County. And as a member of the Public Protection Committee, I got appointed to that group and so chaired that quasi-judicial hearing. And Dane County voted to disbar Rawhide Boys Ranch from any future placements, and we did not make placements there.
And then right after that, we had the homophobic dentist on the public health board.
We did. This was in the AIDS crisis, and we had a resolution that was going through the Board of Public Health to encourage increased federal funding on it. Lynn Hayden and I were the sponsors of that. And our jaws just dropped when basically he said, well, you know, that's the price you have to pay for sexual adventures. And that he showed, you know, didn't feel you shouldn't spend any money to fight AIDS. So we asked then Dane County Executive Jonathan Berry to remove him from the Board of Health. And Berry did accede to that request and remove the dentist. And then there were petitions for and against him, and it went to the courts as well. And they upheld Berry's power to remove him. So I call that the dentist who needed extraction.
We're talking with Dick Wagner. His book is coming out, Moving Forward, Wisconsin's Recent Gay History. So we get to AIDS in the early 1980s. The big legislative achievements of the Consenting Adults Bill and the Gay Rights Bill happened right before AIDS really developed. Could they have been passed once the crisis hit?
It's unclear how much that changed things. David was able to get AIDS confidentiality into the state budget, which in the early days of testing, people were so concerned that the test for AIDS would be used as a marker for homosexual and then be used as a basis for discrimination. There were talk of quarantine camps and the military using it perhaps to discharge people. So there was a lot of controversy about testing and how reliable it was. So the Democratic caucus was fine with David's provisions, and Governor Earle supported it, though he vetoed some of the language, but he supported most of it, which prevented discrimination based on the AIDS test itself. But clearly that helped change some attitudes and harden some attitudes about homosexuals at that point. But the AIDS crisis also had a remarkable thing in that it drew the gay and lesbian community together to help build support for AIDS patients and to fight back against the homophobia that was being displayed about AIDS. One of the other things I tried to do in the book was explain how, because Wisconsin had been in the forefront of non-discrimination, and because you had a supportive governor in Tony Earle, he was able to open the doors to the State Medical Society for us to go and meet with them. They came out with a very early statement about AIDS care, being very positive about that and referencing cooperation with the gay community on testing sites and for counseling for people who might be testing. And so you had a much more positive response about AIDS in this state because of the advances that were made in the early 80s than you might have had in some other states.
Speaking of Tony Earle, you have a chapter entitled Tony Earle, Profile in Fabulous Courage. Why was Tony Earle so important?
Tony was very important because he was the first governor who sought support from the gay community. He did an interview with the early issue of Out, the gay newspaper, and he was very positive about gay issues. He was knowledgeable about them. And then he asked Kathleen Nichols and I, another supervisor on the Dane County Board, to serve as co-chairs for Governor's Council on Lesbian and Gay Issues. This was the first such council in Wisconsin. It was the first such council in the nation to actually use the positive words gay or lesbian. There had been others on sexual privacy or sexual minorities. But this actually talked about making known the contributions of the gay and lesbian community around the state. And so we were able to take that council on the road to meet with local officials and members of the gay community, in many cases, conversations that had never happened in those communities. Where the local gay community had access to the elected officials and administrators who were deciding programs about their lives. And so Tony was vilified for that. The discussion was that the Earle administration was a granola administration of fruits, flakes, and nuts. And we, of course, were the fruits in that mix of granola. And Tony never backed down on his support for the community, and the community was ever thankful for him for that.
How much do you think his support for the gay community factored into his defeat in 1986 by Tommy Thompson?
There's some of that in the post-election analysis. None of it is conclusive. I mean, you know, he had tried to put a prison in Milwaukee, and Mayor Meyer refused to support him over that and over municipal aides and things like that. He had to raise taxes because Lee Dreyfus had given away all of the money that had been built up as a surplus in the state. And so the Chamber of Commerce and Republican types were against him for Tony the Taxer. So it's nothing definitive that you can argue. Certainly it was part of the rhetoric about it at the time. But I personally come to no conclusions about that.
Now, it's 490 pages of text and then notes and index. But even with that, you still had to cut two entire chapters of the book. What did you have about Wisconsin authors and academics that you had to lose?
There was a remarkable series of Wisconsin academics who helped do research about gays and lesbians that they published during this period. Evie Beck wrote about nice Jewish girls, about lesbianism in the Jewish community. Ruth Blyer wrote about gender and changing attitudes about homosexuality, particularly women. And Claudia Card wrote about lesbian ethics in a very seminal work that was important in her field. So you had a whole series of academics who were doing wonderful research in this state, and they tended to support each other. You had things like Jim Stakely, who wrote about the Nazis and their crusade against homosexuality and the whole emphasis about the growth of the sexual reform movement in Germany before the Nazi era. And so there was a remarkable flourishing in the community. George Mossy himself wrote about some of the issues of male sexuality and how homosexuals were portrayed as well in Europe. So all of this was a big growth in the research base of knowledge about homosexuality.
Sort of a parallel to some of the academic work you talk about in the first book, but perhaps from a different perspective.
Right, it was a different perspective. And I have a chapter in an upcoming book about educating democracy, renewing the Wisconsin idea, about how at the time when Van Hise talked about the university serving the boundaries of the state, most people think of that as geographical boundaries, but it was also social boundaries. I mean, you never would have thought of the university serving homosexuals when Van Hise made his remark, because they were all criminals or sick. And so you had a whole series of academics that I do discuss in book one, and which I recount in this other book about educating democracy, about how they changed the perception about gays and lesbians being part of the actual demographic nature of the state, and that they were inclusive in the university serving it. And so this chapter on academics would have demonstrated how that had really dramatically changed by the time you got post-Stonewall.
Now, you were in Wisconsin during the entire time period covered in the book. How much of this material and information did you know contemporaneously, and how much did you have to learn afterwards doing the research?
I knew a lot of it contemporaneously, but the research revealed a whole lot more, the nuances and the other actors that I wasn't necessarily all familiar with. One of the things, I have a chapter on LGBT media, and that was a remarkable resource for me. I had saved 40 boxes of gay archives myself, including a lot of gay media. And so one of the things about Wisconsin gay media was important to me was that they claimed to be a state media, and they were speaking for the state, and they tried to cover the state, papers like Alt and the Wisconsin Light. And so if you think of Chicago, you would have the Windy City Times. They covered Illinois a little bit. They covered Chicago a lot. So you didn't have that kind of statewide gay community in other places that you had here in Wisconsin. And I think it was due to the nature of statewide gay media that helped create that statewide gay community. And I think that's, again, a unique Midwest experience for us.
And how much of that LGBT media was directed at the LGBT community, and how much of it was directed towards the broader straight community?
Most of it was directed towards the gay community itself. I mean, you had to realize that most gay folks had very little knowledge themselves about homosexuality. And so, you know, they were recounting stories from gay history. They were talking about sort of where were the boundaries of the community. I mean, how much is S&M included? How much are trans people included? How much are bi folks included? And so all of those issues were helped sorted out in the gay media in the state. But you would have other journalists who would read gay media who weren't necessarily part of the gay media, that were part of straight media. And so they would pick up on stories from the gay media that would then get replicated in the larger media throughout the state. So the audience was really the gay community itself, but it had an effect beyond the gay community.
Finally, when you look back on the things you've accomplished in your life, which do you rank in terms of higher lasting significance, things that if you hadn't done, wouldn't have been done? Your years on the Dane County Board or writing these histories?
Tough choice, Stuart. So many things that I did on the Dane County Board are significant and ongoing. I mean, you know, pulled off Monona Terrace, pulled off the Conservation Fund, pulled off the Green Space Plan. All of those things have really shaped Dane County in so many ways and continue to shape the community. But maybe somebody else could have done them, but I did them. And then the books, I don't think there's somebody else who could have done the books. So maybe the books have to stand out.
They're remarkable accomplishments. They're histories that are going to, as history should, they're going to stand the test of time. And on behalf of everyone in Wisconsin, thank you for writing them. And as well, thank you for your service on the Dane County Board and through all your other activities.
I'm afraid that's all the time we had with Dick Wagner. Again, the books are Coming Out, Moving Forward, Wisconsin's Recent Gay History, and We've Been Here All Along, Wisconsin's Early Gay History, both from our very good friends at the Wisconsin Historical Society Press.